I'll use the microphone. Good morning, and welcome to part two of our three-part series. Today, we get to talk about Dybbuk's. Before we talk about Dybbuk's, I have to say, I'm hoping for a different room setup for next week. This feels a little bit like a bingo game. I don't know if they do that here. Is that a thing here? Is that... No? Okay. But if anybody does, you know, shout out B6 at some point, we'll know why. But Rabbi, thank you so much for making the social hall available, and in general for making the series possible. You'll also know that Rabbi Grover has put out sheets on the table that are sign-in sheets. You don't have to sign in, but the opportunity is there to sign up either to receive the weekly email that my Beit Midrash puts out that lists upcoming programs. That's the one with the heading Torah in Toronto, I think. There's also a column there to receive Beth Tikva email. And there's also one that's not for receiving either email, but just if you want the link to the audio recordings for the class, so I can send that out afterwards. So if that's not too confusing, we have those options there on the sheets. There are seats still in the row up front for anyone who's not afraid to sit too close. And lastly, if people could please silence cell phones, that would be great. Always good to announce that in the beginning. If you don't have a phone with you, God bless you. Okay, Dybbuk's. How many people here have heard of Dybbuk's? Okay, so basically almost everybody here has heard of the Dybbuk. I remember as a kid, I stumbled across an Isaac Bashevis Singer book when I was too young to understand what in the world I was reading, which may include me now, frankly. but he talked about Dybbuk's, and I didn't know what he was talking about. What is a Dybbuk? A spirit? Devil? Sorry? Something mysterious.
Something bad.
Negative. I'm getting a head shake from Vanessa over here. Not necessarily something bad. Yeah. A displaced soul. Now we're getting warmer. A displaced soul. So we're going to have to talk about this and figure out what exactly this Dybbuk that we're talking about is. It's going to come down off of the platform. I realize it makes it less visible, but I'm afraid of heights. So, I'm going to try to move from here and see how this goes. As long as I have a microphone, I'm safe, and I don't know what its range is. Is the Dybbuk a Jewish concept? Well, let me clarify, because actually, you have to ask the question, what is a Jewish concept in the first place, right? How do you define a Jewish concept? Anybody want to hazard that? What's a Jewish concept in the first place?
Culture, theology.
Part of our culture and theology, sorry.
What we inherit is a tradition from generation to generation.
Tradition that we've inherited? That's fair. Does that have to tie into Judaism, or can it just be what Jews believe? Jewish folklore. So what I want to get at, a devil. So that's going back to what a Dybbuk is, a devil. Potentially, I won't have to discuss that. But I think what I want to use as my explanation for what a Dybbuk is, and I'm going to go back up here, so I'm going to put people up front and turn around. But what I want to ask is, does this fit into Judaism? Not only is it what Jews think, what Jews believe, but is this Jewish in and of itself? What does it reflect? Because what we're going to find is that it is a bizarre idea. We've already heard a few different definitions here. We've heard devil, we've heard dispossessed soul, or disembodied soul. We've heard a couple of different variations on it. Let me start out by saying that the Dybbuk does not appear in biblical text. The Dybbuk does not appear in the Talmud. The Dybbuk does not appear in standard codes of Jewish law. The first time we find the Dybbuk appear in any explicit way is in the 16th century, which, gives it 500 years or so to play with it. But it's fairly late in the game as Judaism goes. Anybody know what happens in the 16th century that might lead to this sort of development? What are the key focal points for Judaism in the 16th century? Sorry? The Enlightenment? The Enlightenment is coming another century later. Yeah? Pogroms? Later. Witchcraft. Let me ask you this. Yeah?
False messiahs?
False messiahs? More in the 17th than in the 16th. Yeah? The ghetto? I mean, not the ghetto didn't exist, but the ghetto is where we're going. The Inquisition? The Inquisition before this? No, what we're thinking about. Tzvah. There we go. The growth of the Jewish community in Tzvah, in Israel, in Tzvah, and specifically the growth of mysticism there, led most notably, and that's known by the Armenian, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria. He wasn't the only one, by any stretch of the imagination. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero was there before him as a leader. There were quite a few great mystics living in Tzvah at that time. Kabbalah, exactly. The evolution of Kabbalah, moving from the Spanish schools that had been dominant since the 13th century, you find a new development of what becomes known as Laurianic Kabbalah, the teachings of the Ari. And among his students, that's where you first see any systematic presentation of the idea of a bibuk. And of course, once you have a bibuk, you also have exorcism. Because why not? So that's where it starts to show. We haven't actually said what it is, but we will. But it becomes really popular in Europe in the 19th century. And it shows up in literature. It shows up in Shalmansky's play, The Bibuk, right, which was adapted into a movie in the 1930s. I gave you references on your sheets in source number one. Shalom Aleichem. That wasn't me. Shalom Aleichem has a story called Menachem Mendel, which is considered to be a Bibuk story. I think Rashad Singer liked to write about it as well. But here's the question. If something shows up this late in the game in Judaism, this idea of some kind of soul that's floating around, or potentially this demonic possession, the question you have to ask is, the people who start to talk about this, the people who accept this, have to have some way to tie it into the Judaism with which they are familiar. Meaning, you can't just come along and plunk down an idea and say, this is now what Jews believe. It has to be anchored somewhere in Jewish tradition in order for it to catch on. We generally have been, if not immune, but certainly allergic to people coming along with brand new ideas and saying, this is now your Judaism, right? They tried it a couple of thousand years ago. Right? It didn't work so well. The Muslims tried it as well in the 7th century. It didn't work so well. The church tried it multiple times, right from the 10th century into the 15th, 16th century. Didn't work so well. Generally speaking, if somebody comes along and tries to present an idea and promote that idea within Judaism, it's only going to catch on if it has some kind of Jewish root. Somewhere that it can hang its hat. And so the question is, where does this idea of the Dibbuk come from? I feel like the mic just got stronger. Is that correct? Okay, so I just pulled it further away. Signal me if you can't hear me at some point, please. Okay. I brought you source number two. I am going to go back up here, I guess, because I can't really read from it while standing. Okay, we take a look at source number two. This comes from a paper by a friend of mine called Demons in Ancient Egypt. While much has been written on the topic of deities and the dead in ancient Egypt, the systematic study of demons has only recently come to the fore of scholarly studies. Preliminary typologies based on surviving spells, prescriptions, and apotropaic devices suggest the theory that these hostile entities were divided into subtypes in the Egyptian worldview, distinguished from each other by the specific illnesses and conditions they caused, and as well as by the prescribed means of repulsion and protection. You have demonology in ancient Egypt. Incidentally, that word that I had to pause for in there has a role in Jewish law. The word apotropaic. Anyone know the word in Judaism? Sorry. Apotropos, excellent. And apotropos is actually from the Greek originally. It's not one of ours. Makes it into Talmudic language. It is a guardian. Apo, I believe, as the preface, the prefix, referring to something from the outside. And tropos is usually growth, like a tropism. But the apotropos is generally responsible as a guardian for somebody to take care of their affairs. In any case, what this tells us is that in ancient Egypt, they have ideas of demonology, they have ideas as well of possession and even protection from demons, but that's not ours and it's not where we picked it up. If you take a look at source number 3, you move forward in history to the time of Josephus. Now, Josephus lives when? Oh, well, I put it on the sheet. That's kidding. Okay, fine. First century Common Era. What was Josephus' role to the Jewish world? Historian. Before he was a historian. He was a general. Josephus was a general, but he wasn't terribly good at it, so he became a historian. Josephus was a general during the battle against the Romans. And his fortress fell to the Romans. When I was in university, I went to Yeshiva University in New York, and I got a degree in computer science, and then continued at the master's program at NYU. I don't remember if it was when I was at Yeshiva University or at NYU that I learned about the Josephus algorithm, also known as the Josephus problem. Is it all familiar here? Oh, then I can make it up. No, the Josephus algorithm is a fascinating story. The way that it's sort of like Masada, but not. The story goes that Josephus is the general, and his fortress is going to fall to the Romans, and they decide that they're going to execute themselves rather than be captured by the Romans. They're worried about being imprisoned, tortured, mocked, and so on. So they decide, we don't want to give ourselves up to the Romans. And Josephus is the one, as the story goes, who comes up with the system by which they're all going to kill themselves, right? Because the fundamental problem in a pact like this is, who's going to be left at the end? And somehow it works out that the way it works is there's a skip in the algorithm. They all like sit in a circle, and then one will kill the next one, but there's a skip in it, and then the next one will kill the next one, and so on, going all the way around the circle until the last person standing is going to have to execute themselves. And Josephus is the one who runs the program and ends up being the survivor, leading to some suspicion that Josephus was not only a general and later a historian, but also a mathematician. And the problem that you had to solve in my class was to come up with an algorithm that you could use when you're sitting in a circle, a formula that you could use such that, you know, if this were to happen, you'd be the last one standing. So Josephus, when it gets to him at the end, he's the last one, decides not to kill himself, but instead to turn himself over to the Romans. And he becomes a favorite of Titus. And he writes a history of the Jews, several histories, in fact, of the Jews, in which he tries to portray Judaism in a light that will be favorable to the Romans. And you always have to keep that in mind when you read his writings, that he has, it reflects a certain bias. He's trying to curry favor with the Romans. But take a look at number 3, which comes from his Antiquities of the Jews. He's talking about King Solomon, and he says, God also enabled him, Solomon, to learn that skill which expels demons, which is a science useful and sanative to men. He composed such incantations also by which distempers are alleviated, and he left behind him the manner of using exorcisms by which they drive away demons so that they never return, which is the way you should drive them away. And this method of cure is of great force unto this day, for I have seen a certain man of my own country whose name was Eleazar, releasing people that were demoniacal in the presence of Vespasian and his sons and his captains and the whole multitude of his soldiers. He says, I have seen it with my own eyes. Exorcism. And the tradition goes back to King Solomon. Now, Solomon would have been long before this. Right? If you're talking about Solomon, you're talking about 1,000 years before the time of Josephus. But, or a little less than that, but roughly. But Josephus suggests that King Solomon knew how to exorcise demons. Where does he get that idea from? Why assume that King Solomon could do that? It's not explicit in biblical text. Why would you assume that Solomon could do this? Because he's really wise, right? Because the biblical text tells us the story of God coming to Solomon and asking him, what would you like me to give you? Right? And Solomon asks to be able to judge properly. He wants to do the job right. And God is very impressed by this answer. The fact that he didn't say, give me great wealth. The fact that he didn't ask for all sorts of other things. And God says, I'm going to give you everything. And included in the everything is, I'm going to give you great wisdom. You'll be wiser than any man. Now, that still puts him under 51% of the population. But it's not bad. Pause for people to get that. But if you take a look at source number 4, you find from the book of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, one source for the idea that Solomon knew about demons. Solomon describes here all of his different efforts to amass wealth, to amass power, and it's part of his theme in the book about how all of this was worthless. But he says, I gathered for myself silver and gold too, and the treasures of kings and nations. I made for myself varieties of music and human pleasures, shidah and shidot. And the problem is that shidah and shidot are very strange words. And we don't know what they mean. When you get to Talmudic Hebrew, a shidah is a large box, often moved around on wheels, which leads some to suggest that's a wagon. Right, Muhammad, that was what you were going to say? Yeah. Some form a wagon. Sorry, the mic seems to be going up and down. But that's one approach. That it's some kind of a chariot. Others suggest that it's from the word shodeid. A shodeid is a bandit, someone who takes spoils. So he's saying, I took spoils. But it doesn't really fit the sentence at all. And it's not something you were most set that you would make for yourself. So some associate it with the word shadim. A shade in Hebrew is some kind of demon. Right? Not unlike the cognate, I suppose, in English, a shade, right? The problem is that the plural of shade is really shaded, not shido. So it's hard to say. But nonetheless, that's what some pick up on. And they say, so Solomon has knowledge of demons. However, and this is an important however, when we talk about divaks, we're not really talking about demons and devils. That's not really what a divak is. There is quite a bit in Judaism about demons, but it's not really what the Divak is about. We'll need another class at another time to talk demons. It'll feature a little bit in next week's class on magic. We'll have to talk a little bit about demons then. But it's not what a Divak is. Someone said before that a Divak is actually a soul. And the idea of a Divak, as we're going to see, is the idea that a human being passes away and that their soul, rather than go to some place of eternal reward, inhabits somebody else. Possession, in other words. That's what we're talking about. Not demons. Take a look at number 5. Number 5 is one more exorcism example, which I couldn't resist. Bishop Morgan, writing, in the writings of the church, and this is a book against a fellow by the name of Celsus, who was one of the opponents of early Christianity, so he is writing in defense of Christianity, talks about exorcism, and he says you could use the Jewish patriarchs as a means of exorcism. He says, the Jews trace their genealogy back to the three fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the names of these individuals possess such efficacy when united with the name of God, that not only do those belonging to the nation, Jews in other words, employ in their prayers to God and in the exorcising of demons the words God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, but so also do almost all those who occupy themselves with incantations and magical rites. So everybody involved in magic invokes Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. For there is found in treatises on magic in many countries such an invocation of God, an assumption of a divine name, as implies a familiar use of it by these men in their dealings with demons. So if you want to exorcise somebody, this is what you do. or so writes Bishop Oregon. So there's a belief that there's something Jewish about exorcism. Okay, so what we've established at this point is, number one, my assertion from the start that you don't find a divot mentioned in biblical text or in Talmudic text. That's phase one. Number two, then there was an idea classically that tried to associate Jews with demons and demonology and exorcism. That we have as well. But where is the source for the divot? So before we get to that, one more note. Take a look at number six, please. A comment from Rabbi Moses Maimonides, writing in Egypt in the 12th century. He talks about the early idolaters, and he says, these are the people who wrote books on rules of the stars and magic and invocations and spiritual zodiacs and planets and demons and fortune-telling and witchcraft and superstition and seances and many similar things, against which the true Torah has unsheathed its sword and eradicated them. Those types of things are the essence of idolatry. In other words, he thinks none of this is Jewish. He thinks all of this came from the outside, and as far as he's concerned, it's heretical. So, whatever we're going to see on one side, keep in mind that there are those on the other side who are very skeptical this is Jewish at all. But let's now get to the Jewish sources. You see number seven? The Hebrew word there. That Hebrew word is dabek. Although if you were in kindergarten, you'd probably read it dabek. Anybody know what, right? Someone said it? Glue. Dabek is glue, right? In kindergarten, you learn the word dabek. It means something that makes things stick. A divok is something that is attached, stuck to somebody else. That's where the word divok comes from. It's piggybacking on an existing Hebrew word. Okay, but still, we need to figure out how that comes to mean somebody's soul that enters somebody else. So here we need to talk a little bit about the soul. Now, we're not going to be able to spend our whole time talking about the soul, but I'd like to get some explanation in that will be our background here. So, what is a soul? Sorry? Spirit. Essence of a person. What are the characteristics of a soul? Sorry? Feminine? Thank you. The truth of the matter is that it could be either one. I'm not going to get into gender identity. That's a whole other class. Or series of classes. Right, the word neshama in Hebrew is a female word. Keep in mind, though, that souls are known by multiple names in Hebrew, including nefesh, which is a masculine word.
Immortality,
the idea of the immortal soul. So, pinning down what a soul is not straightforward. From the very beginning of the Torah, we're told that there is a soul, that human beings are not just bodies, because God forms Adam, dust from the earth, and he breathes something into Adam, nishmat chayim, breath of life, from which the word nishama that we use for the soul comes. Nishima in modern Hebrew is the term you would use for a breath, but nishmat chayim is the sichut form, I think. It's a legitimate form of the word. Today you probably write nishimat chayim, this is true. But it's a creation that is separate from that of the body. So much so, then when you read Genesis, you actually find human beings created not once, but twice. Right? With different accounts. If you ever read Genesis 1, Genesis 2, the first and second chapter, you find different accounts of the creation of human beings. Because in Genesis 1, who was created first, Adam or Eve? Nope. Together. They're simultaneous. The beginning record in the Torah is Zachar Nekeva Barachotam, that God created us male and female, just like he created the animals. Male and female together. It's only when you hit Genesis 2 that you get this incident in which God takes Adam around, has him name all the animals, Adam can't find a mate for himself, and God says, go to sleep and we're going to do surgery. And lo and behold, you get Eve.
So commentators have wrestled with this question as long as there has been a Torah, right? How is it that I have two different accounts, and one they're created together, and the other one they're created separately? And you can give all sorts of answers, right? One simple answer is that chapter 2 is the unpacking of chapter 1, right? Chapter 1, the point is the creation of human beings. So God's just saying, yeah, then I created human beings, created them together, and later we'll get to the details. And that's one legitimate approach to it. Another approach, though, is to suggest that the opening account is actually the creation of the soul, in which the human beings are created male and female, but they're in one body. And then in the second chapter, God takes this two souls in one body and says it's not good for them to work this way. The Torah says, "Lo tov hayota adam levado." It's not good for the human being to be alone, meaning to be a single unit. I'm going to split them apart, which is what God does, and then you have Adam separate from Eve, and they have to find each other and unite, for which you get all sorts of nice wedding Torah, all sorts of nice wedding thoughts about how the two souls have merged, they found their other half, and it's beautiful. But in terms of what this means for us, it's very clear from the beginning of the Torah that there is a body, and separate from that there is a spirit. But what does that spirit actually constitute? Well, that's subject to great debate. You could read some texts that will support the idea that the soul is actually the human personality. This is you. And the body is just the housing. And that's one extreme. Then you have the other extreme. And the other extreme says the soul is the equivalent of a spark when you turn on your car. Which is to say, it's what animates the body, but it doesn't have its own identity. It's simply what creates the life of the person. And frankly, the further science goes in attributing personality to the brain, to hormones, to the body, the more that view gains traction. The idea that the soul is not the person's sense of humor and not the person's identity and memories. That's really its own class we would have to have about what the soul is, which extreme you go to. There are Kabbalistic texts that talk about the soul as having five different parts, all of which do different things. But the point for us, again, is that the soul is something which is invested into the body, and someone here said before, there's the idea that the soul is immortal. Now, Judaism, going way, way back, talks about people surviving their death. That's biblical. And when I say biblical, you can find it explicitly in the prophets and implicitly in the Chumash. Explicitly in the prophets, Daniel talks about the soul coming back to life in the future. Yechezkel with the dry bones. The best story, though, is one we're going to get to in a little bit, which is the Witch of Endor. Right? In which King Saul calls up the ghost of the prophet Samuel. So the idea of somebody surviving their death is actually fairly clear there. And it's hinted at within the Chumash as well, within the biblical text. When you go back to the five books, as we're going to see very shortly in number 8. Well, let's see it now. Take a look at number 8. This appears a couple of times in the Chumash. I picked this one to use on the sheet. This is part of a set of warnings about quasi-idolatrous practices. There shall not be found among you one who passes his son or daughter through fire. This was an idolatry known as Molech. It was not necessarily that they killed their kids, they passed them into a flame, but rather you have a path between two flames, and the ritual was to pass the child between the flames. It may not be that they were actually killing their children. In any case, don't do it. Or one who engages in sorcery or calculates times, right? We don't like horoscopes. My apologies to Gene Dixon and all of the others associated. Or uses omens, right? We're not into the black hat, for an example. Or magic, and we have to talk about magic next week. Or one who practices charms. Or inquires of or Yin Oni, two forms of sorcery that seek to commune with the spirit world. And the last one, Odoresh Al Hameitim, one who seeks the dead. one who tries to talk to those who have already passed away. The biblical text says that you're prohibited from having a conversation with the dead. Now, I stress having a conversation. Monologues are fine. It's when you're trying to get a response back that we have an issue. There's nothing wrong with addressing someone who has passed away. We have problems when, you know, you're looking for sock tips. Which happens at one point in the Talmud, believe it or not, but that's a story in its own right. Diane?
We're prohibited from counting the omens or magic and counting the signs. But are we saying myself, oh, this is my home, are those...
Ah, that's an excellent question. I had an Israeli cousin who was something of a Davkinik. That doesn't really have any translations. Davkinik. Someone who just because. And he just refused to say mazel. Because mazel is luck. Comes back to the zodiac. Right? So you're wishing somebody good luck or you're wishing somebody good constellation, didn't we just say you're not supposed to calculate times? So, in brief, but it's a very important note, the zodiac is not foreign to Judaism. As a matter of fact, some of you may have gone on tours in Israel in which you see mosaics in synagogues, some of you have mosaics in the zodiac. You gotta keep in mind that if you go back in human history, even as recently as, you know, 500, 600 years ago, the zodiac was viewed as not just as scientific as gravity, well, more so to them than we knew. Meaning, the idea of the zodiac was not that there's some kind of superstitious omen, but to them, and I see a lot of Maimonides that disagree, because, again, who didn't like that either, but the basic idea was that there are invisible forces that are not intelligent, per se. But the same way that there's a force of gravity, the sun exerts a pull, even the moon exerts a pull on Earth, so too Mars or Saturn or whatever, out there in the heavens, exert a pull. But it's not a pull like a gravity pull, it'll be some other influence. And this will influence towards bloodshed, and that will influence towards kindness, or whatever it is. But they viewed this as a natural force. That's not the way they read the biblical text. And the biblical text talks about omens. It's not an anti-science text, which would be to say to be against astrology as far as they were concerned. It's a statement of, don't try to calculate and say, if a cat crosses my path, that's bad for me. That's not scientific. Mars is ascending, that is scientific. So they, from their point of view, wasn't a bad thing. However, as somebody quoted, the Talmud says, Ein mazal l'Yisrael, which doesn't mean Jews have a mazal. What it means is that you can actually be above it. That natural things, which is the way they viewed mazal, don't have to dictate your future. That's a little bit on mazal, Muhammad.
That's it,
but
that's
all.
Yeah. So it's not that
that's exactly the question. Rukama asks the very important question. When the Torah says, don't do this, does that mean this doesn't work? A literal read of the sentence is, this does work. You're just not supposed to engage in it. And so that's what I mean when I say that you have an implicit text here that says that people survive their death. We don't want you talking to them, but theoretically you could. Now, there are other biblical texts as well that can be cited along these lines. The idea that when somebody dies, they go back to their nation and back to their people. There are other references you can bring. But to me, that's the most explicit you're going to find that indicates that people survive their death. Now, once again, every time you do something like this, you have to go back to Maimonides because he's going to have a different spin. Take a look at source number 9. In his work of law, Mishneh Torah, he talks about these practices, including seeking the dead, and he says, all of these are words of falsehood and deception, which the early idolaters used to trick the nation to follow them. He says, there's no such thing as talking to the dead. It can't be done. He believes that the soul survives its death. He writes that explicitly. That's not his problem. But he doesn't believe that you could actually talk to the dead. But this is one example of the soul existing after the body ceases, but it doesn't tell us where the soul goes. Take a look now at number 10. This comes from a woman by the name of Abigail. There is an encounter between her and King David. King David and his men were on the run. They were fugitives from King Saul because Samuel commits the cardinal sin of the Middle East. Right? The cardinal sin of the Middle East is don't coronate the new leader while the old one is still alive. That's what happened there. I mean, he did it because God told him to. But the problem is that King Saul is not a fan of the idea of David becoming the new king. David and his men are on the run. They spend a season protecting the shepherds of a wealthy man by the name of Nabal. They come to Nabal at the end of the season and they like some support. Nabal's response is, you upstart, what, you think you can just claim to be king and people should support you? David and his men are furious. They go on the march. Abigail finds out about it, and she says, I'm going to head this off. And she comes out with support for David's men. And she gives David a blessing, which we use to this day. It's part of the text I translated in number 10. Take a look. Her blessing is, if a man rises to pursue you and seek your soul, if someone wants to kill you, David, may my master's soul be bound in the bond of life. Right? That sound familiar? Right? In the Hebrew, Tien Ishmat Chatzru B'Tzorah Chayim is what we say for someone who passes away. You can see it on headstones in cemeteries as an acronym. Tav Nun Tzadi Ben Hey is the acronym for this blessing. So we use the blessing that she gives, that his soul should be bound in the bond of life with Hashem, your God, and may the souls of your enemies be slung in the bowl of the sling. Well, the idea of his soul being bound in the bond of life, I understand. It's the idea that he should persist. He should continue. He should live on. But what's the business about the souls of his enemies being bound in the bowl of the... Not bound, being slung in the bowl of the sling. It's like a catapult. Right? Yeah?
I was just reading about that yesterday. That had to do with the stones that you put up on the graves.
Oh boy, that I did not realize.
Anyway, this long part is that the stones were there and put stones on a grave in order to keep the souls down.
Wow, that I have never heard, which does not mean it's not true. So that's an interesting one. We have a practice.
The shepherds would go out to take a sheep.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have 40 sheep, and sometimes you'd be taking 10 sheep. So the only way that a shepherd could keep track of how many sheep he was taking up to the flock was to put the number of stones in his sack.
Yeah.
So that when they would come back, he could just count stones, and that would remind him.
So how does that tie into the cemetery?
So it's the same sort of thing to keep the number, I guess,
Interesting. I would need to see that article. If you could email me that article or a reference to it, that would be great. Because to me, that's the opposite of what we usually talk about. In other words, we talk about in burial specifically freeing the soul. There's the idea, for example, that we try to bury in a way that will not preserve the body, because the idea is that the soul is separate from the body. We're usually not into keeping it there, so that surprises me. I want to see what the source is like. The idea of putting stones on a gravestone is usually associated to me with the idea that you're building up the monument. Each person who visits builds up the monument for the person who's buried there, but there are all sorts of other explanations. I once heard somebody link it to a Muslim practice. So, who knows. But let's go back to the Dithik. Her blessing is that his soul should be bound in the bond of life and the souls of his enemies should be slung in the bowl of the sling. Keep that phrase in mind because it's going to be really important. Sorry? It should be al-kaf ha-kela. I remember the word right before that. It's the kaf ha-kela is the end. The kela kuf lamed ayin is the term for the catapult. The kaf is the bowl. So if you flip the page to number 11, this is the story I referred to before. This is when Saul goes looking for advice about what to do. His mentor, the prophet Samuel, is dead. David has already incarnated as king. Saul is facing enemies from without in the Philistines and enemies from within in terms of David. And he says, I need to talk to Saul. I need to talk to Samuel, but he can't because Samuel's dead. And not only that, but he has issued a decree that all of the people who try to commune with the dead should be put out of business, because after all, this is a crime within the Torah. So he goes to a woman who was known as an Ob, as one of these witches, so to speak. That's the way they always translate it. And he wants her to communicate with Samuel for him, but he knows that he can't go to her as King Saul. So he goes in hiding. He dresses up. She doesn't know who he is. And she said to him, behold, you know what Saul has done, eradicating the Ovot and Yidoni from the land. Why are you causing me to stumble, to kill me? Right? You're trying to ask me to do what Saul said I can't do. And Saul swore to her by God, as God lives, no sin will befall you in this. And she said, okay. And she said, who shall I raise for you? And he said, bring up Samuel for me. And she saw Samuel, and she shrieked loudly. And she said to Saul, why have you tricked me? You are Saul. And the Midrash goes into how she knows that. And the king said to her, do not fear. What did you see? And she told Saul, I saw a malach, a spirit. We use malach usually to refer to someone that carries out a job like an angel. I saw a malach rising from the land. And he said to her, what did he look like? And she said, an elderly man rising, wrapped in a cloak. And Saul knew it was Samuel, and he stretched low to the ground and bowed. Now, Maimonides will tell you this is a dream sequence, that this can't happen. But you get the idea here that somebody indeed survives their death and can even relate to this world. Well, if the soul is really surviving its death, where does it go? So classically, we have two places that we are familiar with, right? What are they? Gan Eden and Gehenom, right? Gan Eden and Gehenom, heaven and hell. So Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, has different explanations for what sort of paradise exactly this is. Take a look at number 12, which sounds like it's a very physical place. They quote a verse from Ecclesiastes, which says, a person goes to the home of his world, the Beit Olamo. Right? From this you have the tradition of some who name a cemetery Beit Olam, from that verse. Rabbi Yitzchak explained, each righteous person receives a dwelling befitting his honor. You get a nice house. You were better? It's a nicer house. Not so good? Maybe it's like one of the small houses in Thornhill, you know? It varies, depending on what you did. That's one way to look at it. And then on the other hand, you have others who say, no, it's a spiritual place. Take a look at number 13, from that same discussion in the Talmud. The souls of the righteous are stored under the divine throne. And they quote a verse that will now sound familiar. The soul of my master should be bound in the bond of life. In other words, what she is describing is the Garden of Eden. And it's for the soul, for David's soul, to join the others by the throne of God. Physical reward or spiritual reward, and that's the sort of debate you can't win, right? Because no one reports back. There is in the Talmud one passage in which someone is said to have reported back, but it's a challenge to understand what his report said. But that's the idea of Gan Eden. There's also an idea that people have to go through a period, though, in Gehinom first. Gehinom, has anyone ever been there? No, seriously, has anyone ever been there? Yeah, Moshe's there. It's a place. There is a valley in Jerusalem, right? Gehinom or Ben-Hinom. It's referred to in Tanakh. It was a place of idolatry, and a place even of the worship of Molech, in which the babies are passed through the fire, and so that name becomes the name that's used for hell. But it's actually a physical place. You can take a tour. Sounds funny, though. But it's true. So take a look at source number 14. describes what happens in Gehenna. It talks about fire, the creation of fire, because if you look in the biblical text at the 6 days, you don't find the day when fire was created. So Talmud says, okay, it must have been created on the first Saturday night. Right? There was Havdalah. You had a fire. That's when fire is created. But the fire of Gehinnom was created on the first Friday. Because that's what Fridays are like. No. The fire of Gehinnom was created on the first Friday. So here you get the idea that there is some form of suffering associated with this place of Gehinnom that is even fire related. And of course that's made it into the popular mindset. So I have two extremes. You have a place where people have to be punished for what they've done wrong. It's generally assumed, and the Talmud goes into this at length, that this is not a permanent residence, but rather, person is there, hopefully for a period of up to 11 months, and then afterwards they go into Gan Eden, they go to the place of reward. Right? You can think of Gehenna as some form of purgatory, although the Christians have taken that word and used that in their own way. But those are your two extremes. That doesn't account for the Dybbuk yet, and we're at 45 minutes in. So where is he going with this? And the answer is what comes next. Take a look at source number 15, please. This is the key, and it goes back to Abigail's blessing for David and curse for his enemies. The Talmud, in that same passage that we quoted in 12 and 13, says, regarding the bodies of the wicked, Isaiah 48 says, God declares there is no peace for the wicked. And regarding their souls, they quote our verse from Samuel, one that Abigail, Abigail said, and may the souls of your enemies be slung in the bowl of the sling. One malach, angel, is at one end of the universe, and another at the other end of the universe, and they sling these souls to each other. As per Abigail's curse. So here we have a third idea. Neither heaven nor hell, but limbo. That's what it is. Right? No place of rest. In shalom. There's no peace for the wicked. That's exactly right. Well, that's an interesting idea. Where exactly is it wandering? I mean, from one end of the universe to the other, I get it. But what does that mean? So take a look at source number 16. An attempt in the early 16th century to explain this. Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra was a leading rabbinic authority in Spain, made Aliyah eventually, in that era. And he was asked a question, which I've translated for you here. Question. The following midrash is hard for us to understand. The souls of the righteous and the souls of the wicked alike return, descend, and are buffeted about in the world. As it is written, and may the souls of your enemies be slung in the bowl of the sling. That's this midrash that the questioner is asking about. It says that the wicked and the righteous both come back. And the questioner asks, this is the opposite of our tradition. Further, the proof brought, meaning from the verse, applies to the wicked one's soul. Why should the righteous one's soul be buffeted about? What is this source? He says, where did this midrash come from that says that the wicked and the righteous come back and are buffeted about in this world? What are you talking about? So Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, also known as Radbaz, answers. He says, indeed, we find the passage in the Talmud says the opposite. It's the passage I quoted for you before. The souls of the righteous are stored beneath the throne of glory, as it is written, may the master's soul be bound in the bond of life, and the souls of the wicked are buffeted below, as it is written, and may the souls of the enemies, and so on. However, know that there are righteous people who receive as do the wicked in this matter, such as those who stumbled in a sin which mandates reincarnation until they fulfill the divine will according to his justice. Thus it is written, he devises plans lest anyone be pushed away. He says, you know what? There may be righteous people who have committed a particular wrong which requires that they come back to this world and be reincarnated. And that's his view of what limbo is. He says that Midrash said that both the souls of the righteous, which need this, and the souls of the wicked return, descend, and are buffeted about in the world, hinting at what we have said. So in his view, limbo is reincarnation. Not everybody agrees. Take a look at number 17, please. The Maharal of Prague. The wicked person goes to extremes in his deeds. The opposite of a righteous person who does not stray from the straight path in the middle point. Therefore, a malach stands at one end of the world and another at the other end. Just as he went from one extreme to the other, there are two extremes. So he has no rest. For as you will know and understand with deep wisdom, the extreme has no rest. Therefore, the malach who stands at one end does not accept him, for he is associated with the extreme, and so he slings him to the second extreme. In his view, the view of the Maharal of Prague, limbo is reserved for people who strayed from the middle path that the Torah approves of. They went to extremes in this world, and they will go to extremes in the next. And so they don't get to rest in a place of reward. They don't even get to rest in a place of punishment. But instead they wander. This is not reincarnation. This is a wandering. And now we finally come back to where we started. We had said that you don't find any reference to a divok, to possession by a human soul, in the biblical text. And you don't. You don't find any reference to it in the Talmud either. It's not there. But what you do have is reference to limbo. There is this idea which the Talmud sees in Abigail's reference as a place which is neither heaven nor hell, neither Gan Eden nor Gehinnom, and which is understood by some to mean a requirement of wandering. And where the Divok idea gains traction within Judaism is the idea that the soul that's been wandering may find a home for itself. The home it finds for itself is in a body that's already occupied. So that an idea of a divok, which starts out as not a Jewish idea at all, migrates into Judaism by adapting to this idea of limbo. So that, take a look at source number 18. Rabbi Yaakov Chaim Sofer, author of a very important legal work called Kaf HaChaim in the world of Sephardi Halakha, Sephardi law. This is actually a very important work. And he says, there's a blessing that is recited every morning in which, depending on your edition, depending on your text, a person will thank God, saying, "Thank you for not making me a slave." Right? There are different editions of that. He says, why do you say that blessing every morning? Why do you need that blessing every single day? Now, I would have said, because I'm grateful every day to be free. But take a look at what he says. It is also possible to explain that during one's lifetime, one might become, quote, pregnant with one of these, meaning one of these souls for the slave. Each night, one's soul gives an accounting for its creator and is judged for its deeds. Sometimes they will give it another soul in the so night or the secret of pregnancy. What he is suggesting is that you're thanking God that you didn't gain a divok overnight. That's what he is suggesting. You're thanking God that a soul did not migrate into you. Now, I have to say, his legal work is generally fairly dry. He's not given to flights of fantasy. But as far as he's concerned, this is a legitimate idea within Judaism. Sprung from the idea of a soul that survives death, tied into the idea that a soul can go into limbo, he's willing to accept the idea that a soul can even migrate into somebody else's body. Now, here I want to come back to something I did last week that I felt bad about afterwards. When we talked about the evil eye last week, I felt like I came out at the end too uniformly negative in terms of evil eye practices and too much on the, call it, rational side of things. In terms of interpreting the evil eye, more in terms of jealousy and avoiding people's jealousy and avoiding people's eye and their prayers against you. And I believe frankly that that's what the evil eye was meant to be. Ayin Hara was meant to be about the issue of jealousy and averting that jealousy. But I really don't mean mean to minimize or to take lightly the opposing view that sees in it something that's more significant. And I want to make sure that I'm clear about that in this point as well. From my understanding, what we're seeing here with the idea of the Dibbuk is an extrapolation from classic Jewish texts, taking it beyond where it was initially, this idea of a limbo, and applying it to the idea of a Dibbuk. Are we clear? That doesn't mean that a Jew has to believe in Dibbuks. The fact that we have now found a source for it, a person could be a believing Jew and still deny the Dibbuk by pointing out the fact that it doesn't appear in the Talmud, it doesn't appear in biblical texts. One might also be a believing Jew and accept the idea of the Dibbuk and say, well, look, now I found my sources. Excuse me. Now I found my sources within Judaism. But I think what it really speaks to, the whole idea of the Dibbuk, what it really speaks to, is our uncertainty about what happens next. Where do we go? Right? We only vaguely referenced reincarnation. And we're not going to, in the next 2 minutes, discuss and explain reincarnation. But there's a war within Judaism as to whether reincarnation is a Jewish idea or not a Jewish idea. And there were those classically who said that reincarnation is Jewish, and not only that, but even transmigration of souls into animals was Jewish. Rabbi Sadia Gaon, writing in the early 10th century, ridiculed it. And he said, they look at a dog and they say, oh, that dog resembles so-and-so. It must be that that's first the person's soul that's come back in the dog. He didn't take this very seriously. He thought it was not a Jewish idea. But fundamentally, what it comes down to is, we know that we have a tradition that has elements of the soul surviving death, and we don't have enough information about where it goes, and that's what leads to the Dibbuk idea. Connected to King Solomon, if you will, Shidava Shidos, connected to some of the other texts that we found, Abigail, but that's where it comes from in Judaism. I look forward to next week and a discussion of magic. Thank you very much.